Good morning, Graham Church. You look good this morning. You always do on Time Change Sunday, at least this one. In a little while, we are going to come to the Lord's table, which is called communion, or sometimes we call it the Lord's Supper. It's one of the strangest things that we Christians do. In fact, it's so strange that the Romans accused the first Christians of ritual cannibalism because of what happens here at this table. It's been misunderstood. Some people have turned this into a rite that they think earns God's pleasure. And a lot of non-Christians, and if you're not a Christian here this morning, welcome. We're glad that you're here. A lot of non-Christians think that this is really weird, if not even bizarre. So what does it mean? Matthew 26, 17 to 30 shows us. We are in the last chapters of the book of Matthew, and the events surrounding Jesus' passion are moving along very quickly. Jesus has just told his disciples that he will be crucified during the Passover, which is only 2 days away. Judas has sold his soul and has promised to betray Jesus for not much more than the cost of a Big Mac, 30 pieces of silver. Now, if you were making a crime movie out of these events, you might say that things are spinning out of control. But they're not. God has a plan, and Jesus knows exactly what he is doing. We learn here that Jesus is on mission at all cost to make a new relationship between God and his people. And Matthew 26 is recorded for us to show how deliberate Jesus is in going to Jerusalem and paying the ultimate price to redeem sinners like you and I. He goes voluntarily. He goes intentionally. He goes knowingly to face the conspiracy against him, because it is only by going to the cross that he can fulfill the mission that God the Father has given him. So, verses 17 to 30 are all about Jesus' mission to rescue broken people and fallen people and hurting people. And Matthew shows us three ways that Jesus faces his mission. Number one, Jesus is intentional about completing his mission. Number two, Jesus won't be detoured by enemies to his mission. And number three, Jesus embraces the cost required by his mission. Number one, Jesus is intentional about completing his mission. So as we enter into this Passover, where we began reading a few moments ago in verse 17, the observance of the Passover was the biggest event on the Jewish calendar. It's hard to imagine for us, but the celebration of the Passover was even bigger for the Hebrews than Christmas is to us. Pilgrims came from all over the Near East and Israel. They came to Jerusalem for this celebration. And the city teemed with activity as merchants sold their goods to travelers and beggars positioned themselves in perfect locations to get some change, and families looked for the lamb that would become their sacrifice. At 3 o'clock p.m., the offering of the Passover sacrifice begins, and it takes place in three massive shifts. Each person, once they were inside the temple courtyard, will slaughter his own lamb and drain the blood into a basin, and then will throw that blood at the base of the altar while the priests sing. And they're singing the Hallel, which is Psalm 113 through Psalm 118. And after they skin the lamb, they place the fat and the kidneys on the altar, and the pilgrims gather with their families for the Passover meal. And this is the preparation that Matthew mentions there in verses 18 and 19. All of this has to be done as backdrop to this Passover meal. The disciples gather in a house of an unnamed man to celebrate this important holiday. So their purpose is the same as everybody else in the country, everybody else who's in the city, the same purpose, the gathering together for Passover to remember the day when they came out of Egypt, out of the house of slavery by the strong hand of the Lord. But this Passover meal is different. Jesus has made very careful arrangements in advance. And this strange conversation between the Lord and his disciples is here to show us that Christ is the head of the family. Instead of a nuclear family gathering together, it's Jesus and his disciples. He's the head of that family, and he's done everything to make ready for what comes next. He has made his plans. Why? Because this is the final Passover celebration. The final Passover celebration ever. To remember the day that the Lord delivered his people from slavery, Jesus knows that something is going to happen on this Passover that has never happened before. The Passover is going to be fulfilled. Finally, completely, finished, done. It's finally over. And Jesus has made all the arrangements. And the plot of those who would kill him is already underway. The betrayer has been paid. The conspiracy is set. And Jesus walks deliberately into the Father's will. Jesus is intentional about completing his mission. Number two, Jesus won't be detoured by enemies to his mission. As Jesus and the 12 recline to participate in the Passover meal, the Lord makes a stunning statement, verse 21. And as they were eating, he said, "Truly I say to you, one of you will betray me." Now this is shocking. And each of them are asking themselves, "Is it me?" Every one of them know that in their hearts they are deeply flawed by sin. Every one of them recognizes that they are capable of the worst sin. Is it I, Lord? First, Jesus cryptically answers their question by saying, the betrayer will be the one who has dipped his hand in the dish with me. Now, he's talking about the custom of dipping the food into a sweet sauce or into a relish called harosheth. In other words, he's saying the betrayer is one of them, one of these guys around the table, one of these fellows in the room. Second, Jesus connects it all to the Father's sovereign plan. He says, the Son of Man goes as it is written of him. Now, if you read with a careful eye, you'll see all through the Old Testament that Messiah is pictured as a suffering servant. And Matthew frequently quotes these passages in the life of Jesus, that Messiah is not just reigning king, but he's also the suffering servant. Finally, Jesus warns about spiritual disaster for the betrayer. Woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that man if he had not been born. So he's talking about the worst possible fate. Catch the irony here? You see the tension here? God plans it. The Bible predicts it. Judas did it. And he will pay. So we have here, right in this passage, the tension between divine sovereignty, God plans everything that happens, and human responsibility. The one who does it will have to answer for God. He is responsible for his actions. God works his plan. Judas is a willing participant. He's not a pawn. He's not a puppet. Both these things are equally true. And you know, for some people, this just pops your circuits. I mean, you can't connect these things in your mind. You say they can't both be true. But they are here. They're clearly here. Judas is responsible for what he'd done, even though God has planned it from time past, from eternity past. Consequently, Judas is a name that is forever associated with betrayal. Nobody calls their kid Judas. And his betrayal of Christ will incur divine judgment. You see what's happening here? The ultimate crime committed by a close friend against God's chosen one results in final good. The worst crime in all of human history has as its consequence the good of all those who will be saved. Now, this is quite a remarkable event, and it is a defining moment. Just think of it. In the middle of the most important celebration of the Jewish calendar, Passover, is a meal which pictures the ultimate deliverance of God's people. And in the middle of this meal are both the beauty of the fulfillment of God's plan and the horror of betrayal. But Jesus won't be detoured by enemies to his mission. God has a plan. Number three, Jesus embraces the cost required by his mission. Now, this meal, which you've seen on the famous painting, people call it the Last Supper, it might better be called the Last Passover. In this Passover meal, Jesus Christ, in the clearest possible way, explains the meaning of his death. Why did he come, and why is he dying? Why is this meal so significant? First, we're shown that Jesus' death is central to his mission. This all happens at the Passover meal. And that is very, very, very intentional. The timing is deliberate. All the history of the people of God has been moving toward this moment. Every return from exile, every deliverance from every tyrant, every substitutionary sacrifice of every animal, everything that has happened in the whole history of redemption and the whole history of God's work with his people, everything is moving toward this. This is the climactic moment in the history of redemption and the history of the world, right here, right now. And Jesus couldn't say it in a more amazing way. By taking the Passover meal, he didn't need to use the Passover meal. He could have done it some other way. But by doing it in a Passover meal, he's saying, everything has been pointing toward me. This is the climactic moment. This is the deliverance above all deliverances. This is the exodus to end all exoduses. Now, interestingly, this is actually the only thing that he ever tells people to do over and over and over again. Even though Matthew doesn't record Jesus' words, but in Mark and in Luke and in 1 Corinthians, Paul gives his words four times in the Bible. He says, do this in remembrance of me. Do this. And so the Lord tells us to perpetually remember through this meal the way God originally said the same thing in the Passover. Do you see? There's only one thing that Jesus Christ actually tells us to do over and over and over again. Not a dramatization of his birth, although we do that nearly every Christmas in the Christmas program. It's not a biblical command. Not a dramatization of his miracles. Not a dramatization of his life or of his teachings or even of his resurrection. Over and over and over again, he wants you to dramatize his death, to visually give an image, a picture of his death, which means this is the main reason I came. This is the central thing. I have nothing to give you unless you believe and understand my death. Nothing unless you grab this. So, Jesus is saying in the Lord's Supper, in the last Passover, my death is central. His death is central to his mission. So why is that? Why did he die? Because sacrificial self-substitution is the meaning of Jesus' death. Verse 27. And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, drink of it, all of you. For this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. He uses that expression, poured out for many. Now, that's not accidental. Every Jew understood exactly what he was talking about. That word, that expression, poured out, is Old Testament sacrificial language. Poured out for many. That English word for can mean so many things. I'm doing something for you. It could mean I'm doing something because of you. Or it could mean I'm doing something in response to you. But the particular preposition used here in all other and in all other places where Jesus' words are given in the Last Supper, what he's really saying is, my blood is poured out on behalf of you, instead of you, in the stead of you. They hear that. And they automatically, as good Hebrews, their minds instantly go to Isaiah 53. This is the language of sacrificial self-substitution. And there's no better way for him to explain it. So, Bible scholars, what is the main course of the Passover meal? What is the main thing? What is, you know, you got all these other little interesting things, but what is the main thing of the Passover meal? It's the lamb. A lamb was the point of the Passover. God had said to Pharaoh, let my people go, let my people go, let my people go. And Pharaoh continually said, no, no, no. Finally, God comes to Moses and said, I'm going to put a final stroke. I'm going to send the angel of judgment, the angel of death, and he's going to pass over the land, and the angel of judgment is going to strike opposition and violence. And the way he's going to do that is he's going to strike dead the firstborn of every family. God says to Moses, Pharaoh will let you go, and this stroke will redeem you. This stroke is the one that will get you out. He says, you slay the lamb, of course, and then you eat the lamb, but you take the blood of that lamb and you smear it on the doorpost over your door, so when the angel of judgment comes by, the angel of judgment will pass over you. God does not say, when judgment comes, it will only hit the bad people and not you good people. It will only hit the Egyptians and not you Jewish people. It will only hit people who have wrong religion, not the people who have right religion. No, no, no. What's he saying? He's saying, when my judgment comes down, every single household will be subject to it. Every house. Why? He's saying, spiritually, you are alienated from me. Spiritually, you want to be your own gods. You want to be your own lords. And your selfishness is destroying my creation. In other words, you are all sinners. What God's saying is, you will not be saved tonight unless you put the blood of the Lamb over your door jamb and take shelter under it. So what did that mean that night? First, every family, the family would have to admit, we're not going to be able to survive if the angel of judgment comes by. The only way that we can survive is if the lamb is slain. And every home in the country, there was either a dead lamb or a dead son. Every home. It was one or the other. So it's saying every firstborn son who survived that night looked down at the lamb and said, that lamb died for me. Now notice something interesting. Here at the Passover, the last Passover, this supper, this meal right here. You notice what's interesting? Where's the main course? There's no main course. Jesus is the lamb. And Jesus never refers to the lamb. Jesus never points to the lamb. We don't even know if there was a lamb there. There may have been, there may not have been, but it's not referred to at all. Because Jesus Christ is saying to them, do you really believe, friends, that our firstborn sons were saved because of some little woolly sheep? Our firstborn sons were saved because God was going to offer up his firstborn son, and tonight he does. So Jesus Christ is saying, I am the substitute. I take the judgment. I am slain, so you are not. So now we have to make it all our own. We all have to take ownership of what Jesus is talking about here. It's not enough to academically understand what happened in that room, but every single one of us have to take ownership of what Jesus is showing us here. So, by taking up Jesus' body and his blood, you appropriate his self-substitution. Now, that's a mouthful. That needs a little bit of explanation. But it is so crucial to your spiritual life to understand that sentence. The death of Jesus Christ does not automatically or necessarily do anything for you. You can starve to death in the presence of a meal. You can sit there and look at that meal and literally die from lack of nutrition. You have to do something. You have to take it. And so here in Matthew, Jesus does not say, "This is my body." What he says is, "Eat it." He doesn't say, "This is my blood." He says, "Drink it." So what he's saying is, you must learn how to make the benefits of the cross your own. You have to pick it up. You have to take it. And when I eat and drink the bread, and when I drink the cup, remembering and thinking about what his death means, the Spirit of God, in a more profound way than anywhere else, takes the cross and shapes your heart with it. The Spirit of God brings the cross and makes it real to your experience in a more profound way than anywhere else. More profound than your quiet time, than your devotional life. More profound than your community group meeting. All of those are very important. But this is the one that Jesus said do over and over and over and over again. So when I look at the bread and when I look at the cup, I see the cross. I appropriate the cross by faith to my heart. I see how much he loves me. I see how precious I am to him as his child. And it changes me. He makes me like himself. If the cross is a living reality in your life, That means you know that it's a humbling thing. You know that you are so lost that there is nothing less than this that could save you. Nothing less than the death of Christ. And that humbles you. And you used to feel superior, and you used to feel superior to other groups of people. You no longer feel superior to that because you see the cross. And you see what Jesus Christ had to do to rescue you. The cross represents Jesus Christ dying for us while we were his enemies. It's the ultimate pattern of someone doing self-donation to someone else, to the other race, to the other gender, to the other class. So Jesus Christ cross humbles us. It gives us a pattern. It becomes a living reality in our life. And so because of the cross, my relationships with other people change because I'm humbled and I can no longer see people the way I did before. And the result of Jesus' substitutionary self-sacrifice is a new covenant between God and his people. That's what comes out of this. Jesus offers himself as a substitutionary self-sacrifice, and what is given to us is a new covenant between God and his people. So the Lord there in verse 28 uses this expression, "This is the blood of the covenant." Now that's strange. If you're not a church-going person, that's an expression that really doesn't mean a whole lot. Maybe you've heard that word covenant in a wedding ceremony. Maybe you really never really thought about it a whole lot. But to the Hebrew ears around the table there at the last Passover, they knew exactly what Jesus was talking about. He gets this phrase from Moses, Exodus 24. Moses took the blood and threw it on the people and said, "Behold the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." Moses threw that lamb's blood, that oxen's blood and threw it. And it's all pointing to the ultimate lamb, the ultimate covenant. So that begs the question, what is a covenant? What is a covenant? A covenant is a relationship. Really very simple. A covenant is a relationship. It's a relationship of personal commitment bound by both law and love. You see it illustrated in a marriage ceremony. And that's what we have here. God makes a relationship with us bound by both law and love. So Tim Keller explains it like this. What's a covenant? A covenant is a relationship, but it's a relationship more loving and intimate than a merely legal relationship, yet more binding and enduring and accountable than a merely personal relationship. The covenant is a stunning blend of law and love. It's stunning because it's a personal relationship made more loving and intimate because it's legal through voluntary, mutual, binding promises and vows to be loving and faithful no matter what the circumstances. That's a covenant. Now, everybody is saying, I want a personal relationship with God. Yeah, that sounds good. I'd like to have a personal relationship with God. But I don't think I want a covenant relationship. I don't want a covenant relationship. And the Bible says that is impossible. God only relates to us on the basis of covenant. Every time he relates to somebody, whether that be Abraham or Adam or Isaac or Jacob or David or Moses, it's always covenantal. Every time he has a relationship with somebody, it's always covenantal. And this covenantal relationship is a category-busting thing. It's this mixture of law. It's bound by law, but it's also characterized and driven by love, and it creates the most profound, fulfilling, life-changing relationships. And above all, it's the only way that you can relate to God is through covenant. So, here at the cross, Jesus inaugurates a new covenant between God and his people. A new covenant. Jeremiah had promised it. Jeremiah 31:33. I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel. I will put my law within them, and I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Law and love is what drives this relationship. So, what we have here at the Lord's table, in a manner of speaking, is a covenantal renewal ceremony. We're coming back, and we are looking at the cross, looking at what Jesus Christ did for me to establish a relationship with me. And I am being drawn back to this covenant that God has made with me. And we are to remember what Jesus Christ did for us and how he took the curse of the covenant so that we could be in relationship with him by grace. Jesus Christ embraces the cost required by his mission. What's it cost him? To rescue you? Everything. Everything. And you can't have that covenant with him unless he pays that price. So, never, ever forget what it cost God to pass over you. That's the message right here. That's the message we're coming to in a few moments. Never, ever, 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 ever forget what it cost God to pass over you, what it cost God to have a relationship with you. When you forget, you'll get proud. When you forget, you'll start loving those other idols. When you forget, you will think the things of the world have more beauty than the things of Christ. But when you remember, then you'll know how much of a treasure you are to him and he is to you. Think on what Jesus Christ did for you. Think on how much he loves you. Exodus 12. It is the Lord's Passover. The blood shall be a sign for you When I see the blood, I will pass over you. This day shall be for you a memorial day, and you shall keep it as a feast to the Lord. All pointing to Christ. It is his blood. He is my Passover lamb. And Paul describes it this way. Paul, in case there's any doubt where Passover was going, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5:7, "For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed." Why do we not celebrate Passover? Why do we not sacrifice animals? Because it's been fulfilled. It was fulfilled that night 2,000 years ago for you. And the cross is what proves God's love for you. The cross is what bought you and made you who you are today, Christian. Never, ever, ever forget the cross. Christ came on mission to rescue his enemies, to deliver those like you and I who are lost and without hope. And this is why the Lord says, "Come to the table and do this in remembrance of me." Do this. Remember the cross. Remember the price that Christ paid. When you resolutely reflect on what Jesus Christ did for you and what it cost him to redeem you, when you do that, you link more deeply into Jesus' heart and into his people, and your character will be transformed so you become more like him. So what's this passage teaching us? It's showing us that Jesus is on mission at all cost to make a new relationship between God and his people.